Hello and welcome to Kingdom Quest episode 448. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always,
Hatless in Seattle, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer. You can just call me Joe, that's fine.
And it's Splatoon Raiders release week.
Yeah, I've been playing some of that.
Me too. And
it's fun.
Beyond hooked. I haven't even tried all the different weapon types yet.
Splatraders. I'm still getting through the tutorial, so I haven't hooked myself in yet, but I'm getting there.
Well, remember I was very upset when Amazon said it wasn't coming on Thursday, it was supposed to come today, but then it came yesterday, but I didn't get a chance to play it yesterday or today. So I have it on as we speak. Just started a new game.
Excuse me, here they are known as Scamazon. Thank you.
A dollar sign in there.
Yes. Let's say yes. I like that. Note accepted. Okay. Note accepted. Yes, as you can tell, we probably don't have a lot to talk about this week other than Splatoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any questions, and we don't have a fire miner.
I can't blame him.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep it short. I'm tired.
Yeah, it's fine. It sounds like I played the most Splatoon Raiders. I guess I can talk about a little bit about it.
Yeah, maybe I'll play it right now while we put the talk.
Yeah, it's kind of exactly as advertised. Like, I honestly don't remember too much of some of the single player modes in some of the other games where you fought the salmon things.
Yeah, they were pleasant enough, but they were tutorials for the multiplayer modes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes.
So this has way more meat on the bone, which I don't even think I've seen all of it yet. Like, there's essentially three different classes. They're not really called classes. There's a speed tank, a power tank, and the tactical tank, those being ink tanks, and each of those have access to different gadgets, which are essentially your skills. And as you're probably surmised already, if you haven't read much about or watched much about this game, it's basically a looter shooter.
Nintendo coming in to rescue you in your time of need.
Indeed. But thankfully, Nintendo being Nintendo, they don't fall into a lot of the pit traps that some of those games do. Namely, a billion different weapons, all of which suck ass.
That's not their style.
But, I mean, there are these weapons can play vastly differently. Like, there's a Splatana, which is like a ink katana that shoots ink, but you can also get in close range. There's like the roller, the ink roller, it's a bow and arrow. There's all kinds of different just ink shooters. There's like, what the hell is this thing? I think it's essentially a bucket. Like if you've played Splatoon before, especially Splatoon 3, which I think has most of these or all of these,
Yeah, this is definitely them also figuring out how they can reuse a bunch of assets.
Yeah.
But that's good. We like asset reuse here.
No, that's good. And this, speaking of Destiny related things, I could picture a game like this where you build your character and then play traditional Splatoon multiplayer with your kitted out weapons and gadgets and stuff, and that might actually be pretty cool. So I am already envisioning and hoping that this continues as its own thing, or maybe they just incorporate it into Splatoon 4 It's like it's got the single player and it's got the multiplayer. Maybe they're connected, maybe they're not. But this just works. It when it works really well, and like a lot of the dungeon things you go on aren't super long. So it's very good for like shorter play sessions. You can get up to four people doing the dungeons. It's very, very fun.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's probably still a lot more for me to see, so we'll see. Especially the different gadgets for the different tank types, they play pretty differently, so there's a lot of variety for you to play around with. There's, again, the different weapons to play around with, mixing and matching the different weapons with the different tank types. And it's not like you're locked into one tank type. You can switch them in between missions whenever you want and level them all up separately. So yeah, I'm going to be playing this game for a long time.
Nintendo once again wandering into a genre like a decade after everyone else did and making everyone else look like clowns.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. There's a lot, like, Borderlands has been trying to get this sort of formula right forever, and they're still wasting my time with open world. And I don't understand why.
Like, also, this game hasn't made me sit through anything that resembles a claptrap.
Yes, that's true. There's actually no real voice acting. It's all the Splatoon talk. But it's definitely well written. The characters are entertaining.
Oh, yeah. Like, especially if you liked the duo from 3. Like, they came back. So it's Shiver and Fry.
Yeah.
I am a huge fan of Shiver.
Yes. I have her amiibo right here.
Oh.
The new one. Nerd.
So the new one.
Oh, double nerd.
The new ones unlock outfits in the game.
Of course. You're a nerd.
Yeah, so just to add on to what you were saying, like, you know, I remember I played Splatoon 1 on the Wii U, and I really liked the gameplay and stuff, but again, it had a very limited single player, and it was focused on multiplayer. And then Splatoon 2 comes out on Switch, and I'm like, oh, this is great, and it had a little more single player content, which I still didn't end up doing, and I bought the expansion, didn't end up doing it, but had some fun online. And then 3 comes out, and it's like, okay, well, I know I'm probably not ever going to get around to the single player, but hey, the multiplayer looks fun. Let's play that. And, you know, I was very impressed with everything. And then with the Switch 2, Splatoon 3 did get a patch. So Splatoon Raiders looks and performs on par with the way 3 does on Switch 2, which is nice. Just doing the tutorial right now. And it's like, yeah, what I always wanted from this series was just a full-length single-player campaign. That appears to be what I'm getting here. And I always like the co-op mode, the survival mode with the Salmonids. Like, we did that a couple times.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It doesn't have, like, the meat.
No.
I don't know why I keep talking about meat on the bone. Like I'm hungry or something. But yeah, it doesn't have the depth that this does. And it's a shame it's taken them this long, because like the shooting mechanics in Splatoon are excellent. But if you can't dig the competitive multiplayer, there's not much else to do with those mechanics.
And some of these kids are just so damn good, I just can't beat them.
Yeah.
The thing that's always been interesting and that makes Splatoon actually very suited to the genre, this like action RPG looter shooter genre, is that the tension that always exists within it is how much to focus on like aiming and shooting fundamentals. And Splatoon mechanically has always de-emphasized the weight of like precise aim. Like that, like its entire genesis of its design was to create a shooter where it was still helpful to miss.
Right.
Like the base.
I've never really thought about it like that, but it's totally true.
Yeah. The base design of the multiplayer is that hitting an opponent is much less of import than hitting something.
So just keep firing. And raiders, because of that emphasis, is allowed to focus more on like position yourself out of harm's way and keep your aim trained on a large target. And then build the encounters around like here's something that flies and here's a small thing that's like able to run up on you and here's a big thing that creates big blast radiuses, and you put all these together and you have like an interesting thing that is built around the interesting movement mechanics that you have, where your misses are also creating spaces for you to go. And so those mechanics actually slot perfectly into this kind of thing where like you with something that's more precision shooter derived, you end up with the question of, well, I shot perfectly, but the numbers don't work for me. And there's less of a feeling, like that feeling is trained out of the players by the nature of how shooting works in Splatoon.
Right.
So it's just, it's a really good use of like, they clearly started this project from like, what can we do with all of these like existing designs, mechanics, this world people really like, but you know, like there's three Splatoons, like they're all really good. What can we do that doesn't, you know, that, you know, allows us to do something with this already beloved IP, this really great art design, but which might reach players who don't necessarily want that, who don't want the competitive multiplayer. And so we get this cooperative multiplayer looter shooter action RPG.
I was a type of Splatoon player where I would use the roller and just try to cover as much territory as I could and kind of ignore enemy players if I could, you know.
I love the roller.
And I felt like I was contributing to the match, even though my kill death ratio may not have reflected that. And in contrast, you know, we're playing Overwatch last night, and there were a couple matches where I had so many eliminations, but we still lost because I didn't do a good enough job taking the objective, or maybe our teammates let us down a little bit because they were treating every match like a death match. So yeah,
but I was like aiming at your opponents is generally not the play unless they are stopping you from taking territory.
Right. Now, and then one gripe that I had with the games though was simply the fact that in casual matches you only got turf war. And there were some other really cool modes that you only got in ranked, you see.
Like Salmon Run.
Yeah. So. And then sometimes Salmon Run would be like, oh no, you can only play it during this 12-hour period on this given day. It's like, but why though? So they did make some weird decisions about
I can understand that. You're trying to keep the multiplayer experience fresh, which can be difficult.
I think the other reason that, like, this isn't the only game I've seen do that, I think, but, like, you know, Splatoon is obviously the most popular game I've seen do that, but I think the other reason that you see games do that is that it creates a situation where people are not selecting a mode, idling and waiting for there to be enough players for a match. If you designate specific times where it's like, it's Salmon Run time, someone logs in, they're playing a match immediately, and like, you know, if that's your preferred mode, it can be frustrating to not be able to play it all the time, but it does mean that when you do want to play it, there will always be a match.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Because I've definitely seen that hamper a lot of multiplayer games that have a lot of modes.
Yeah, the more modes you get, the more that like people can splinter themselves off into, and you can build around this where like people are allowed to be pulled, like you can have user definable settings where it's like you can be pulled into a match of a different type while you're waiting for this one to fill up. But that can create its own frustrations if, for example, the match type actually does fill up while you're in a match of a mode you didn't actually want to necessarily play. there's a lot of little gives and takes, but especially for a game that is primarily targeting children, it's useful to just say, no, just go play.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Splat Raiders is one of those kinds of games that like I'd love to see more of, where someone just took like, you know, it's a silly comparison. It's a Majora's Mask. You've taken an existing set of assets and like mechanics. Like, you know, this was definitely just someone started with the Splatoon 3 code base and moved from there. But you've taken that and you've looked at it sideways and found a different way for it to function. And like, obviously this needs new systems built into it. Like the entirety of Majora's Mask needed to be built around a time system. But by building that one new system on top of all these old existing ones, you've made a game that is unmistakably its own. And we can justify talking about it because it's an RPG.
Yeah.
It really is.
Good on these devs. They did a great job.
So I think it's good to, again, just bring up the fact that since the Switch 2 came out, like, we've already gotten Mario Kart, Donkey Kong, Mario Tennis, Metroid, Kirby, Yoshi, Splatoon, Star Fox. It's like Nintendo's just cooking with all these first party games, you know?
And a lot of them are really interesting. Like, you look at, like, I need to pick up Yoshi because it looks really interesting, because it's not
different.
A normal, it's not just a, it, like, it's, again, it's taking some of those, like, ideas from prior games, but it's making something else. Like, also, you can call Shy Guys Larry's for some reason.
I played the demo of the Yoshi game, and there's a whole stage where you're just planting flowers and then carrying the pollen to cause more flowers to come up to reach new areas. I'm like, that's just so cool.
Yeah, like it's a puzzle game in a way that people did not expect.
So, yeah, that game is very interesting.
Yeah, I feel like because a lot of what they've, like, several of the games that they've released have been knowingly niche titles, like Yoshi, at least niche as far as, like, the kind of person who discusses games on the internet, which is a very, which is a niche unto itself. Like, that needs to be understood. We are a small group.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there's a lot of us, relatively speaking, we're a small group. But they've released a lot of, like, titles that do not appeal to that niche, even though they've also released several that are absolutely, like, squarely aimed at us, like, or not necessarily squarely, but definitely we're, like, being considered in their creation, things like Bonanza or this. But, you know, that they've gone very hard on finding new experiences, and like the Switch 2's, like, output so far is, I think, by the online crowd being severely underestimated, because some of them, it's like, I, you know, I'm not one of the people that grew up with Air Ride, so I didn't give Air Riders a try. I didn't, like, I just wasn't paying attention to the Yoshi game. It's like, no, like, you're sleeping on some really great experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's some games, like, I didn't get Kirby Air Riders yet. I didn't get Yoshi yet, but it's like, man, you know what? I do think I've been sleeping on these whole franchises for years. Yeah.
Definitely. Air Riders was a very funny thing to, like, experience with wheels.
Yeah. It's like, what?
I'll have to play some more of that at some point. City Trial is legitimately one of the best modes that anyone ever came up with.
Pretty cool. Yeah, they're killing it with their first party games. Meanwhile, other first parties are producing shit.
Yep.
Because I have they're seen.
I don't remember them producing.
Well, when they are, it's not very good. I have seen some video of Halo Campaign Remastered, and I am not impressed.
Campaign Evolved looks
whatever
so
the
bad.
Hell it's fucking called.
That's it. Yes. Microsoft is just still doing Forza Gears Halo, and now we're getting a pre-prequel of Gears and a re-remaster of Halo. It's like, come on, guys.
Campaign Evolved is one of those games that, like, it's such a weird project to have produced that there's zero doubt to me that it came out of, like, some sort of desperation, like a hard deadline. Game must exist for
this by this period, or so many people are fired, you don't understand.
Right.
Like, and you know, that makes me like, you know, I'm sympathetic to the people forced to work under those conditions, but like for Microsoft itself, this is like you reaping what you sowed.
Mm-hmm.
Like they clearly were told, like, you know, get Unreal Engine working with Halo and get a game out. And like a remake was the only thing that could possibly work. Honestly, to me, the right move would have just been to make Halo 3 Anniversary.
Mm.
But yeah, they went for Campaign Evolved. I think the truly damning thing, aside from like, Jesus Christ, why does this have a sprint button? Halo 1 was not built with a sprint button in mind. The damning thing is that the only thing I've heard about the actual new content, which is the three additional missions, was, oh, these are bad. Like, that is a bad place to be.
Ugh.
There's no... The fact that you can't even play original, like, multiplayer, like... Oh my god.
I don't understand.
Halo is, as a franchise, more than basically any other, needs to convince people to play multiplayer games like a normal human being again. To play multiplayer modes for reasons that do not involve a treadmill of like rewards and battle passes. Like, we've seen that they couldn't do the battle pass, they couldn't hack it with Infinite, but more importantly, like, it's just not designed, like, the aesthetic of Halo does not allow for the kind of customizations you need to be able to fill out a battle pass. The cadence of the multiplayer does not fit a battle royale. The like, there's just a million reasons that Halo, like, it's of a different era. Its design does not suit these conditions. And the most important thing for them right now is to condition people to care about old school multiplayer, and they have decided to instead wave the white flag and get rid of it. And like, you know, that Halo 1 campaign's classic, but you know, even at the time, if it had just been campaign, it would have been an 8, not a 10.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and like, so that's why a lot of the reviews of the remaster are like, oh, this is a 7.
I mean, the funny thing to me is like, what is this competing against? It's competing against itself.
Right.
They're competing against themselves because
describe how much worse
the Master Chief Collection.
Yes, like you need this to justify this thing's existence. It has to be in some way better than the Master Chief Collection, and I don't see how any of it is at all.
Unless the very notion of a game looking old will make you want to die, there's zero reason to do this. No. And like, I just. Like, the other thing, and, like, this is one of the problems I see every time I look at trailers and screenshots, is Halo 1's aesthetic is very much designed around that 2001 technology. Like, mm-hmm. It is a game whose, like, environments, it's, like, art design, they're both built around, like, well, what can an Xbox do? Like, and... Ultimately, that means that, like, you had these big open expanses that were relatively undetailed, but that worked because it made them look weird and alien. And now you've got these big expanses that are very detailed, and they no longer look alien in the right way. And so the art direction has to try to pick up that slack, and it's always going to be hit or miss because it's drawing on top of something that's already there. I'm going to go look at how much the Master Chief Collection is right now.
I think it's $40 full price.
Yeah, I'm just being like, what could I... Yeah, so it's $40 on Steam if you want to go that way.
Although I don't think that there might be some, you might have to pay for Halo Reach and ODST. This
Oh
might be
no, you'd
extra.
merely get like four games instead. Oh man, it's what a waste. It's $10 per game.
I mean, and
If you were to decide, oh good.
I was just gonna say the other thing for me is I'd be terrified to see how this game plays. Like, my opinion of the Unreal Engine is declining over the years, and like
From my
the
understanding, oh good.
it, did they capture the shooting feel of Halo? That
Yeah,
was just
so
gonna be
the
my
reviews
question.
that I've, the most positive note I've seen in reviews is people saying that it does feel like the original
Okay,
campaign.
well
It
that's
does
something.
feel like Halo. They've done a lot of customization to make it feel like Halo. Like that to me is probably the majority of what this project actually was. The other thing I was going to say was if you feel like going physical, Halo the Master Chief Collection on Xbone at even just at GameStop is $30.
Yeah, I've seen
But
it go on
yeah.
sale for 10 though.
Oh yeah, it gets cheap. I'm just saying like the
Yeah.
you could purchase Campaign Evolved, which is Halo 1 with new graphics and some of the weapons and content. Like weapons and enemies from Halos 2, 3, Reach, all that. Or you can purchase a compilation that just has all of this. But yeah, it's just in yeah, I don't understand the consumer the per like in the sense of like I know that there are some people that will purchase this. I don't understand their motivations. I don't
This
understand them on a very fundamental level.
reminds me, wasn't didn't they do another remaster of Gears 1 after they'd already done a remaster of Gears 1?
So they did, yeah, they did an Ultimate Edition at some
Jesus fucking
stage.
Christ.
Which I think might be different than the one that's like I think Ultimate Edition was the Xbox One one, and it's like Reloaded came out on PS5, and it's like these like the Gears of War 1 is 20 years old, and if you're not going to do anything to it except release it again. I
Hello.
think the reachable
Hello.
consumer base has already been found. Hey, Gaijin.
So, consumer base for what?
Gears of War and Halo.
Ah,
We were
Halo.
talking about the various like re-releases of those in response to the release of Halo Campaign Evolved. God, what an awful name. Like that's a name that requires you to understand inside baseball elements of what they have actually released in order to understand why the hell they named it that. It's like Combat Evolved was the original, and we've updated it, but we've only updated the campaign. It's Halo Campaign Evolved. That's a fucking stupid name. I'm gonna have to sit here and explain that to some fucker. Oh, back to Splatoon Raiders so I can stop thinking about this.
So I've just finished like the first like tutorial mission, and now I have the roller and I picked the big orange tank, and this is awesome. I have like a like an axe dash move. That's my gadget.
Oh
That's
yes,
freaking
yeah, because you have that. Yes.
freaking awesome.
Yes. I had pre-ordered Manta Quest 3, Jesus.
What?
I was one of the
Okay.
lines for the Manta Ray thing. Because
Oh,
like
that's right.
you're saying
Yes.
like
I forgot he said
we're gonna
that.
go yeah, we're gonna go hunt for treasure and your fucking Manta Ray's like, but I had pre-ordered Manta Quest 3. Relic grant special power.
the moral of the story is, it's nice to have actual video game companies in charge of making your video games, and giant conglomerates can go fuck themselves. Thank you. Not that some video game makers aren't giant conglomerates, but whatever.
Yeah.
But the more irons they have in the fire, the worse off we get.
Yeah.
I'm just enjoying double jumping now.
Oh, we have some Fire Miner questions now.
We do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yay.
You can't hear me at all. Oh,
yeah,
no.
I think the RP Gamer stream was outputting the game audio somehow. I don't know. Because, I mean, I have it I have it super low. It should be putting out any game audio. So I'm not sure what was going on. Okay. It's not that hard for a game to get a Persona 5 or Nier Automata collaboration. However, Naoki Hamaguchi said in an interview... Naoki?
Yes, that's much better.
Okay. That while a lot of companies asked to have Tifa in their game, Square Enix judged that only Street Fighter 6 had enough prestige. First of all, just how lower on the Square Enix totem pole is Nier Automata to Final Fantasy? I assume extremely lower.
Well, the answer, well, I don't think it's that. I think it's like each one, like different parts of Square Enix seem to have like a lot of control over their IP, which is why you'll get like weirdness where like some games will release in very different fashions from each other, or how like Cloud and Sora appearing in Kingdom Hearts, not in Kingdom Hearts, in Smash went, and like the various restrictions on like number of musical tracks and that kind of thing was different from Dragon Quest Hero. Like, I think that there is a lot of control in terms of the different parts of Square Enix kind of get to do what they want. And I think that, like, in general, the FF7 team has been more protective of how their characters get used in crossovers, as opposed to, say, like, the Nier team, who seems much more happy to be like, yeah, like, boost the...
Let's do it,
boost,
yeah!
Yeah, like, boost the series, like, awareness by putting 2B in everything.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I think that's what's actually happened here. It's less a business thing, per se, although, like, obviously all those teams are making business-motivated decisions, but that like, they are given some level of autonomy as opposed to being brought, as opposed to having their decisions ultimately deferred to some sort of branding department.
I was going to say, I mean, Japanese creative teams tend to have a lot more say in how things get used, even if they don't actually have a final decision at times. So, You don't see it nearly as much as like an American company just going, yeah, we own this IP and we don't care.
Yeah, like pay us the money.
Yeah. I mean, granted, there is some degree of that in Japanese business as well, but the named creator of a work or an IP does have a lot more, at least a word to say in there. Like, like for One Piece, I'm sure Oda does not make every possible marketing decision in regards to One Piece characters or anything, but he does have a say in how far the marketing can go.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's considered to be like a do not piss off people. Don't piss off the person that like theoretically should be in control of this.
Chris, granted, part of that is just a very different basis of where the IP copyright lies in Japanese media. Yeah. compare and contrast to, for example, Detective Comics' long and sordid history from the 30s onward.
Let's not talk about Bob Kane. We don't have to.
No, we don't. This is not that kind of podcast. I'm just acknowledging that part of reality to contrast to the Japanese part of reality.
So. Yeah, I understand.
Let's see. Oh, Harmony's in the chat. What's up?
Shiny new game, yes.
Farmer says, and secondly, is an open editor toward collaboration better than a selective one or vice versa?
I think there's bad extremes to both of these ideas. Like, obviously, like, if you're too open, your brand gets associated with garbage.
I'm thinking Hello Kitty here, where they really went with all sorts of stuff put Hello Kitty on, and occasionally went a bit too far, and they had to rein it in a bit in the 90s.
it just becomes a point where, like, to both your brand, it looks like, oh, this is making us look cheap, and to the people that you're theoretically trying to sell, like, it is worth spending your money to collaborate with us. It becomes like, why would I do that? Why would I want to be associated with that?
Well, yeah, let's just
I was going to say, as opposed to a similar situation in Japan with Kumamon, where the entire point of Kumamon is to promote Kumamoto Prefecture, and so all you need to do in order to get Kumamon involved in a project of yours is to write a nice letter to the prefecture office saying, please let me use him.
Make sure that you're not going to embarrass the prefecture.
I mean, there is a short, like, selection process going on, but honestly, Kumamon is, as long as you ask nicely and aren't breaking a certain set of rules, Kumamon is pretty much free to use for anybody. Partly because he's just there to promote the prefecture, and that's why he's like, I can't remember if he's the number one or number two mascot character in Japan still. But he's definitely rivaling Hello Kitty for the amount of theoretically but not actually paying licensed goods.
He works hard.
Because they don't actually charge. Mm-hmm. As far as the prefectural office is concerned, if you're using Kumamon in something, you're basically advertising for the prefecture for free.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Exactly.
And they have found it to be a really good deal.
So what I was going to say about Hello Kitty was that 20 years ago, when I was in college the first time, I was trying to buy a gift for someone at the last minute. It was a female friend of mine, and I'm in Target. And I was supposed to meet her and her mom, and it's like, and she's calling me like, where are you? I'm like, I need some ideas. And she said, oh, I like Hello Kitty. I'm like, oh, you do? Great. So I just grabbed something that had Hello Kitty's face on it. And turns out it was like a Target sandwich maker. So, like, you use it to, like, heat, you can make, like, grilled cheese with it or something. Oh, but it's like, but I was in a hurry, and I was like, oh, you like Hello Kitty? Oh, great. Let me just grab this thing. But then she liked it, so it worked out.
Okay, we'll call that a
victory. Granted, that's probably one of the less embarrassing things you could have grabbed with Hello Kitty on it.
Right. Well, because in the college dorms, like, we didn't, like, we had these mini fridges, and that was about it. But, I mean, the idea was she has her own little thing to make a grilled cheese or maybe French toast or something to that effect. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually a pretty good choice there. Yeah,
okay, it actually worked out.
The other end of, to hit the other end of this question, I do think that, like, to some extent, they may have been overly protective of what they do with FF7, that it may have, that it limits the amount of exposure that people outside of the existing fandom see of it, and that like, that's the issue with protecting the brand too much, is that, like, it doesn't get exposed to more people, and especially younger players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's currently the problem they're trying to solve. But FF6 is a good start because SF6 is a, you know, a game that has a lot of visibility and a lot of broad appeal.
Yeah, and it's funny playing
character pass for.
it's still funny playing Kingdom Hearts for the first time, and it's like, okay, yeah, it's Final Fantasy and Disney, so it's like it's Final Fantasy 7 and 10 characters and stuff. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess, I don't know, trying to introduce Final Fantasy to kids, sure, you know, or...
So Sophie is here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's... and like I said, I streamed for 3.5 hours thinking I was almost done, and turns out there's a whole nother dungeon at the end of the world with like 8 bosses, and like, oh, great. So killing Maleficent in her black dragon form was not the end of the game, no. So
cool fight, though.
Yeah, it was.
I'm sure it was epic, anyway.
Yeah, it was.
There's also like 6 or 7 bonus bosses that exist because you're playing the Final Mix version.
Yeah. But,
unless you really know the game, you don't want to bother with those.
So then it's funny how the guy from Final Fantasy VIII shows up and he's just kind of like, yeah, you know, you got to go get this thing or you got to go here. And then Yuffie and Aerith try to be a little helpful, but for the most part, you're kind of on your own in that game.
Yeah.
Although Cid is actually quite helpful. And I finally found Cid in FF7 Rebirth, and he's awesome. You know, I'll just sit here and scratch my ass while you get the money.
Cid's great in Rebirth.
Yeah.
But yeah, like...
I mean, of all the things I might wonder about the Final Fantasy VII Remake, worrying about Cid was not high on the list. He was pretty good the way he was.
Yeah,
and I couldn't really imagine a way that would fit in the game that I was seeing being advertised that they could do to actually mess him up. So
we've seen a bit of his gameplay in Revelation, and I appreciate that he has all of his stupid limit breaks up to and including that little weird one where he summons a little dragon. I'm very excited. I'm very excited to finally play him again. That's kind of they're at. I guess I will bring up the only part of the FF14 fan fest that interested me, a non FF14 player, which is they have the big multiplayer raids they're doing are, one of them is FF7. And in that discussion, someone like Naoki Yoshida and Naoki Hamaguchi broached the as yet unspoken question of who is making FF17, and joked in such a way that it might be Hamaguchi's team. If I can pull up the exact thing that I was reading.
Wait, I'm sorry, refresher, what did he work on?
7 Remake.
Okay, gotcha.
It would,
so that's what,
yeah,
so that you guys are happy. Okay, yeah, if it was the team that did 14 and 16, you'd be livid. Okay.
If it was that, I would wonder why the hell they were doing it. But
right,
okay.
Yeah.
Yoshida, I think it's one of the biggest compliments people were saying in the comments. They wish Hamaguchi was making FF17, but you don't have to answer. Hamaguchi responds, if I answer, and then Yoshida says, no, don't. So I would suspect that like he's at least pitched an FF17.
Yes, please.
I would love for the FF7 remake team to get to make a new game together that is like their own original creation.
Yeah,
I will be there with bells on.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I got what I wanted out of that, which is to say, I wasn't paying attention to the MMO part.
Sorry, I have some more comments here.
Okay.
How appropriate is it that Bubsy 4D is only an above average game buoyed by its jokes? I would disagree that it's only above average, but whatever. Which other game hit the mark of staying just above the audience's expectations?
I mean, a lot of them, but
I'm trying to think of like games that have done this before.
Three on four gamer scales for.
Yeah, but like I think that like there's a slightly more nuanced question that Fireminer is asking here of games that people didn't expect to be good and therefore feel happier about when they turn out to be pretty good, even if they're not amazing.
Yeah.
As someone who was aware of the property they were rebooting when they did it, the fact that Spec Ops The Line is a good, interesting video game is completely baffling.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people even remember the PS1 Spec Ops games that was a reboot of.
I never heard of those Race games Man. Except for that one.
Way like late in the PS1's lifespan, 2000-2001, there was a full-on Spec Ops series that Spec Ops The Line was like a reboot of, and like they're bad. They're very, very bad. They're sequels to Windows games that I've never heard a single person talk about. But the reason that like anyone would have dug back into the IP is that like Spec Ops Stealth Patrol and its sequels on PS1 did millions and millions of sales. And they did that because they were 2000 era PS1 games when Sony had released all restrictions on how cheap you could price something. So Spec Ops games came out at $10 new. And those sold millions and millions of copies on the basis of being, oh, it's a new shooter and it's only $10. Let's try it. And this ain't so good. But
the rough does not begin it.
Yeah. They produced 4 of them in an 18-month period.
Yikes.
Yeah. Not good, but one of those things where like Spec Ops The Line being good felt like I was being like trolled by reality itself.
Not just good, but it's like a commentary on the whole genre, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. Like it would be like if I'm trying to think of like I just think of an old war movie that's not good. Give me just a moment. Let's see. Now I've got it. It'd be like if they did a remake of Pearl Harbor and it was like an insightful commentary on an insightful commentary on like U.S. military intervention.
Pearl Harbor sucks and I miss you. Okay.
But yeah, like, so that's the one that always sticks out to me. It's like, I'm just happy. I would have just been happy if this was not terrible. The fact that it was good is frankly baffling.
Okay. I'm going to say one I could add for recently would be Wiseman's World. Just because, I mean, like, okay, I'm literally the only person on site who remembers this game existed when it was announced for in English. I'm like, what? Because I put up screenshots for it twice on Japandemonium like 16 years ago, literally. And it's like, okay, mid-period DS game, really re-released with some mild upgrades for Switch, and it's, I mean, it's decent. I mean, it's not going to be setting any records or winning any People's Choice Awards, but it's still a decent game. I'm like, okay, this is probably the best I could have hoped for. Okay.
I also just thought of a couple of other absurdities that might fit this bill.
Yeah.
So one of the ones that was confusing at the time and remains confusing is that 50 Cent Blood on the Sand is not a bad game. The sequel to the much maligned 50 Cent Bulletproof, released for the Xbox 360 and PS3, about 50 Cent having to shoot his way across the Middle East in order to obtain a diamond encrusted skull that has been stolen from him. Bafflingly
Okay.
competent. Absolutely no idea how that happened.
Quite likely somebody else was making an interesting game and they just put his name on it.
I have no idea what happened, but it's pretty decent. In a similar vein of like, why is this random celebrity game pretty good? Bujin Gai, which was at the time in the mid 2000s, a Taito developed PS2 Devil May Cry knockoff starring Gackt. And actually pretty good.
I mean, to be fair, there's a
Don't know
joke
why.
that like half the Final Fantasy protagonists are based off of Gackt in some way.
No, I know that joke well, but like this was the one where like they actually officially licensed his likeness. It was advertised alongside him in Japan, and it's pretty good. It's a neat little game. Very sort of weird wuxia inspired, plays pretty well. But yeah, I love but Bujin Gai is another one of those things where it's like when someone in the mid 2000s told me that they were making a Gacked game, I was just like, oh, that'll be terrible because that's just it's a celebrity vanity project. Why would anyone purchase that? And yet here we are. And I guess I will bring up this one because historically it is of note because it was forced to surprise someone important. Nintendo originally shut down the idea of making Mother because Miyamoto did not think that Itoi would commit to the project. He thought that it would be like Takeshi no Chosenjo or some of the other celebrity endorsed Japanese games of the era where they would slap their name on a video game because video games were new and popular and not take part and the resulting game would be bad. So Mother 1, in order to enter production, Itoi had to commit like, yes, I will be in the office, I will be actually managing this project. I will not be pushing it onto you guys to make a game for me. And so that was a key reason as to why Mother One was allowed to happen. And then Itoi made Mother Two and Three and his most beloved product, Shigesato Itoi's number one bass fishing.
What?
Yeah. For both Super
Real
Famicom
thing.
and Ultra 64.
Okay.
Okay, I'm sure there's other questions.
Yeah. The funny thing with the Hello Kitty collaboration is that
Ubiquitous.
ubiquitous Sanrio characters
Sanrio,
can
that's the company that owns Hello
company.
Kitty. They have a whole bunch of mascot characters.
Characters like
they've got a like index full of the things, yeah.
The kitty have several terrible collaborations, but the actual collectors always look for the more obscure characters as a sign that the collaboration has some teeth to it. Interesting.
It's if you're if we're just like if you just came to us to collaborate and you have no, and we have no faith in the product, here's Hello Kitty. If we have faith in the product, then you're gonna start getting like weird things like that dying egg creature.
Yep.
I forget what its name is. Yes, Gudetama. But yeah. I think I will continue describing it as a dying egg creature.
I mean, it's kind of, yeah, but
It
I mean,
looks like it's suffering.
it's alive, but it's kind of given up on life.
I respect its views on life.
What else we got? Hero Harmony, the best gift, in my opinion, is something the person normally wouldn't get themselves, but likes. So good job, Joe.
Oh, why, yeah. Thank you.
It's important. Like, maybe it's hard to find, or maybe they don't realize how much they'd want it. Mm-hmm. Either way.
And then, unfortunately, then I dropped out of college and never talked to her again, but oh well.
Whoops.
That's life.
Yep.
Swings and roundabouts.
And then years later, her mom was my grandfather's caregiver briefly before he passed, and she recognized me, and it was a little awkward, but she was a nice person. Yeah.
I would hope so.
Yep.
Given the circumstances.
Yeah.
All right, next question. Hero Harmony just has a few comments. Yes, it's good that the remakes did not shy away from OG weird things. I'm not sure what he was talking about.
I think that was in reference to when I was talking about like all of Sid's weird moves, including his weird limit breaker. He's a little dragon.
And then he says Yoshi P needs a break, as long as that break is not working on a mainline Final Fantasy game. Game of Thrones Final Fantasies, please. Yes, I wouldn't even call it Game of Thrones. I would call it 16, just bad.
Like, it's clear that, like, there's a multitude of, like, influences that produce 16, and Game of Thrones is, like, something that they talked about in interviews. Like, we had everyone watch a season or two of that. They definitely played some of the reboot God of War games. They definitely watched some Godzilla movies, and, like, As we look at these, like, all of these are interesting, like, good, but they didn't, like, combine them in a way that feels like it fits, and they didn't execute on them well as individual projects. But
Then Fireminer says, oh yeah, someone extract the English script from the DS version of Flower, Sun, and Rain to make an English patch for the PS2 version. It's a lot of things, and I don't know what they are.
Flower, Sun, and Rain is one of Goichi Suda's early games. Like, it's been forever since I even attempted to play this. This is a weird game. As his early games especially tend to be. But as I recall, you're kind of, like, brought into, like, a time loop to prevent, like, a bomb going off. It's like a sort of, like, adventure game.
I was going to say, which time period was it made in?
Like 2002.
Yeah, time loops were really big from the mid-90s until like a decade and a half, two decades later. Yeah, I believe
them
that.
Back. I miss them.
No, I mean, they got overdone to begin with.
Yeah, I know, but I miss them. See, but yeah, the only version that ever came out, at least in the US, was the DS version. The DS port having been developed by beloved contract developer Hand. Should I explain who they are? World ends with you, contract developer.
Oh, okay.
Flower, Sun, Ryan, let me double check what its actual synopsis was. You arrive on a Micronesian resort island of Los Paz, taking a room at the Flower, Sun, and Rain Hotel. Like, fucking Suda and his, like, games where the place you are staying is the name of the game. We'll call that meta-tech. You fail a mission, a bomb explodes, and a Plane crashes into Los Pass, and then you wake up in the hotel room, and it's a you get into the time loop. But this was a May 2001 PS2 game about like bomb explosions and plane crashes, which leads me to have a very specific assumption about why it did not come out in America.
Yeah. Yes.
Right around the time someone would have been evaluating to decide whether to try to take a chance on that. Like, let me go look out the... Oh, okay, nope, we won't be trying that.
Nope.
Yeah, it would find its way to North America in 2009 when the DS version was localized. But yeah, that 2001 version never stood a chance. It's like that... There was a game that was briefly considered for localization in mid-2001 that was a puzzle game about exploding famous buildings.
Oh, no.
Ooh. I vaguely remember that thing existed, yes.
Yeah, and so they just were like, no, let's not even try this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really interesting game. I'd be interested to see the PS2 game to see how much, like I'm unsure how much they had to compromise to fit it on the DS because I've just never experienced a PS2 version. And it's weird. It's a weird ass game. So I'm interested in that. I'll have to try this. And I haven't seen indications that AI was involved, so I don't have to feel disgusted, so that's always nice.
All right. Next question. Can we talk about games that have a wide appeal to the casual demographic but are seen as flawed by genre enthusiasts?
Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Mamoru Oshii recently talked about how he had sunk over 1,000 hours in Fallout 4 and how it was the exact kind of dirty Western setting he idealized. I don't have to tell you how Fallout fans themselves complain about 4 because it's a garbage piece of crap. That's added by me. Much less old school CRPG fans, right?
Yeah. So what I would even go further and say that like that Fallout 3 and its progeny are like this writ large. I mean, like, you know, the venom towards Fallout 3 has died mostly because there are other things to be pissed off at, but like the venom was there. And like I'm sure some of it will come back when those 3 and New Vegas remasters find their way out. But it's just one of those things that like I think I brought up Mortal Kombat as like the immediate thing that came to mind. That there are games that like have very broad surface appeal that don't have strong appeal to people who play a lot of the genre. Like, excuse me. I'll be the first to tell you that, like, I it's part of the same reason that I'll often, like, couch when I start complaining about action games under the, like, point that I'm an action game snob. So, like, similarly, back in the day, me and a lot of other people would have correctly pointed out the old God of War games were dog water, just terrible, as compared to like their direct competition, which is to say God of War came out like a month after Devil May Cry 3, a game that like absolutely wipes the floor with it. But like the broad surface appeal, like one of those ended up selling like, you know, 6-7 million copies in a year, and it wasn't Devil May Cry 3. And that was just, you know, there's a lot of things that are like this. If you look at like the most mega popular examples of any given genre, there's often an element of this. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I had an interesting conversation the other day with my mailman. Because we've talked a few times and turns out he's into gaming and stuff. But like the day that GTA 6 pre-orders went live or something, oh, did you order GTA 6? And I'm like, no, I didn't like GTA 5. You know, he's like, oh. And then he's like, oh, well, you know, what about Red Dead Redemption 2, huh? You must have liked that. I'm like, no, I didn't like that game either. Oh, so you just don't like open world games. It's like, no, I didn't say that. What are you talking about? Like,
yeah, that's
to some people, it's just the popular games are the only ones that exist. And it's like you tell them, oh, but I like Saints Row. And it's like, oh, well, what is that? I like Just Cause. Oh, I never heard of that one. It's like, but they're the same type of game. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't blame someone for not having heard of Just Cause, given how weirdly they've been released over the years. But yeah. Like,
but it's,
like
it's just what you're talking about. It's like, you know, there are certain popular franchises that aren't necessarily good, and then there's people who think that that represents the genre as a whole. It's like, well, it really doesn't, though. You know, like Saints Row 4 lets you be a fucking superhero and run really fast and jump really high, and that's way more fun than anything GTA ever did.
I think that like one of the things that can be useful for people like us that get like super engaged with games is that it can be useful to try to figure out like what appeal does keep these at the top of the heap, because a lot of times like elements of it are going to be marketing, like people, it's the one people have heard of, and that's noteworthy, but it's not always just that. There is, and like I think it can be worthwhile to try to, like, that's why you'll sometimes see me like dive into some of these franchises and just try to play a whole bunch of them. Like, what is this doing that has this really broad surface appeal? And like, you know, you get into something like GTA or Red Dead, and you'll find that it's like, it's a combination of scale and like really obvious density that like is very appealing, but which is not required to be engaged with. That like they have like a million like obvious subsystems which gives a sense of that exists almost to give a sense of depth that don't all have to actually be in depth, and that the player is safe to ignore. Like, you know, Red Dead, I would point at things like hunting. Hunting is actually a weirdly in-depth system in Red Dead, and it's actually super obnoxious if you're trying to get good at it, because it's like, well, you need to kill this thing, and you can't let your horse run over it, and it needs to be put on the saddlebags in the right way, and then you need to take it and like, you know, skin it properly before it rots, and all these little like bits of system that give the sense, the flavor of depth without forcing the player to engage with the frustrating system until they decide that they want to just wring more out of the game because they don't want to feel like they're done with it. And I think that sometimes appears for action games. It's often the ability to feel strong in a very quickly. Like when I'm like, the same thing that I would critique about the old God of War games is probably what made them appealing, was just being able to like start hammering square and triangle, and then like Kratos starts doing like a million spinning things that hit like five enemies at once. Like there's just enough there that you have to get some capacity to tell what you need to tell what your combos do, but you don't really have to care that much about what they're doing. There's not like a grading system that's forcing you to vary them up. Like that probably had a lot to do with it. You get this with thematics as well, like things like, you know, you look at say The Last of Us, it has like just enough obvious thematic underpinnings to like make people feel engaged without actually being terribly challenging. Like that, you know, that has its appeals. Like just in that, that can be very pleasing to a broad audience. The feeling that like you've been on some level forced to consider something that would normally be subtext, but it hasn't super challenged what you're thinking, like what you would think of if you had just read it on a surface level. Like that, that can be very useful. That's what, where a lot of middle brow entertainment lives, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, you know, I saw The Odyssey a week ago, and that forces, you know, like that wears its heart on its sleeves about what its opinions on war bad is, but you know, it does force it does wear its heart on its sleeve enough that like everyone kind of has to engage with the theme a little bit, and that can be sticky to an audience that is used to, like, especially sticky to an audience that is used to things not really engaging with their own underlying themes, or entertainment as a whole not really engaging with their own underlying themes. So yeah, I think there is, like, and then, you know, of course we get back to like Oshi at the start of this question, like, you know, that like Fallout might have had a stickiness to him just by dint of the fact that it's a world construction that just isn't terribly common in a lot of like Japanese science fiction of the current era. Like just the level of grime and gunge and like being made out of whatever happens to be success, to still be around. And so like that can like, I think that's one of those things that like, since we play a lot of games, we kind of default to caring a lot about mechanics, but a lot of people playing casually are engaging primarily on aesthetic or setting or like you know, favored characters. Yeah, like these things that we would often describe as vibes now, but like they are just like it is worth engaging with the fact that like, yeah, if you're not playing games 24/7, mechanical novelty and mechanical depth are not your primary concern. Yeah. Do we want to hit a few more?
Yes. Let me see what else we got here. When do you realize that your favorite auteur has some pretty pedestrian taste? Mighty number nine.
That's not an auteur. I mean, not a taste issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, like, I, in general, like, I accept that a lot of people have pretty middle-of-the-road taste. In fact, I would venture most. And, like, let's be real, so do I. like, you know, it did not take me long to realize that, like, that, say, Suda51, to pull another, like, obvious, like, a commonly known auteur in this industry, like, he likes luchadors, he likes like dumb American violence shit, like Travis Touchdown is just Johnny Knoxville, like, you know, and you know, it's fine to just like it's, we're all drawing from like at least some shared element of human experience, and we're all drawing from at least some shared cultural touch points, and it's all about making sure that it's interesting. Like, you play old Kojima games and it's like, yeah, that motherfucker loves him some Blade Runner. like,
That guy loves 80s action movies. Like, yeah, so do a lot of people. A lot of people who love them made uninteresting things. You know, like like non-standard reference points are good. They can give you a lot of interesting fuel for your own creativity. But like, they're certainly not the be-all end-all. Plenty of people have like a handful of interesting like interests that clearly influence them, but like their work doesn't become more interesting. Like, this is part of why the phrase, you know, the phrase like good artists borrow, great artists steal exists. Like, the theft of the great artist is in like incorporating something so much you don't even think about where it came from. And, you know, I think that many artists have times where they've borrowed and times where they've stolen. But, you know, like, I'm not particularly down on the fact that, like, I can pinpoint reference points. I think that that's one of the things that makes art interesting, is that it's also a conversation. Like, I wouldn't hold it against, like the film industries of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, where they're all like, you know, even the art films of the era are like, the French New Wave is influenced by you know, American films, as the auteur theorists start like finding directors within the studio system that they feel managed to produce art despite the way that is identifiably theirs, despite the studio system existing to try to make it impossible to identify them. Yeah. And like, you know, they are obviously influenced by that. And then the new Hollywood era of American cinema is in turn influenced by French New Wave. And that's obvious too. If you've like seen the reference points that they're referencing back to, it becomes inescapable. But that's part of what makes art beautiful, is that like, art is a conversation across time. Maybe I'm just like looking at the question wrong.
No.
I don't think so.
That's for the asker to determine. But
oh, Tam did leave a comment in the Discord for us to comment on the whole Atelier ASMR thing.
My answer is that we are going to find more and more ways to juice money out of people who are willing to spend more than the price of a game as a way to get money.
I was just kind of surprised that they hadn't done it sooner.
Yes, that is honestly the surprise here.
I mean, just because since Gust and Atelier tend to, I mean, their main marketing point is the characters more than anything else, and the style of character. That's the kind of thing that somebody should have thought of doing like 10 to 15 years ago. So I'm just very surprised it has not come around sooner. Now, as to the question that was put in the general channel about whether or not Claudia would actually confess her love to Ryza by this point, probably not, just because they want to keep that as vague as possible. But still, seriously, folks, those two just need to have a nice, long, drawn-out conversation in a room. So, I mean, there's a reason why when I did the second review for Ryza 3, I had an image gallery literally labeled non-comprehensive compilation of all the times Claudia is making goo-goo eyes at Ryza. I know I missed quite a few, but I also intentionally redesigned one of the secondary workshops just so I would have another chance at the little cutscene where she is definitely looking at Ryza instead of whatever else is going on at the time. So, yeah. Well,
I think that's it for questions. You want to start wrapping before one of us falls asleep?
Yeah, let's go.
Sure.
Who wants to
buy my book?
There you go.
Ha ha. So, if you are in need of summer reading, we have a series that takes place over the course of one summer, in fact. Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, which is ostensibly a session-by-session account of one dude's niece and her friends just taking over his gaming table for the entire summer. Which, I mean... He's kind of down with that. He's like, okay, I mean, somebody else is paying for the pizza every weekend, and I mean, it's a small miracle to actually get a game going literally once a week instead of like once every blue moon when Venus is in retrograde. So Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, currently standing at 13 episodes, 5 side stories, and a novel-length summer camp paralogue. And also, the last 2 episodes will be out at the end of August. I am planning a sale. Mark your calendars, or, you know, just pick up the books early because they're not that expensive, people. Anyway, this is all under the name Michael Yarimizu, MIKELYARIMIZU. While you're at it, we have Vainglorious Long as the Night, which is a Metroidvania-styled, B-movie-themed lit RPG, which is about as weird as I can make it. So, I mean, in this world of widespread plagiarism machines, the best way to just go about things is to make stuff just too weird for them to have possibly come up with algorithmically.
They'd never do this.
I do my part. I do my part. Continuing on, we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Japanese animal folktales. Some of these are so well known that they have their own Wikipedia pages. Others are so obscure that they probably only were recorded in the books I found them in to begin with. So if you want some interesting tales and reflections on life in Japan, we have that. Slowly working on a second volume in between many other projects, as I've just got too much to write and not nearly enough time in the world to do it.
That tends to be the way of it.
Yep. So skipping to the other pen name, Michael Spearwater, SPEARWATER. No real sales going on this summer, but there is still plenty to read. We have a sort of semi-realistic near future dystopia kind of thing with The Sin of Tantalus. Which is hard to describe at times, because, I mean, basically, the original thought was, what does a story full of zombie themes feel like when the author absolutely detests contagion horror? It's like, the thought came to mind when somewhere I'm just like, no, dude, I've got other stuff to do. I'm doing a zombie story at some point. So this is technically and yet not a zombie story, sort of. It's different though. The Sin of Tantalus, that's one. Then just earlier this month I put out Monsters Among Us Teenage Wasteland, which is kind of a horror comedy creature feature kind of thing. If you like creature feature type of B-movies, this is one for you. Also this one largely, this one currently exists because we're out of spite towards a publisher who just couldn't get their act together and then blamed me for their own problems. Yeah. Okay. So, so stick it to them. Check that one out, please. Again, everything I've mentioned so far and ongoing is available on Kindle Unlimited. So you don't even have to put money down directly to read it. Hint, hint. And honestly, I may not make as much on royalties from Kindle Unlimited, but the feeling I get when I know somebody's actually reading through this, Oh, it is. It is. Honestly, it's worth the price of admission right there. Please, please make my day. Actually, read through stuff. And then, okay, so, and then the last item under the Michael Spearwater name, the hard sell here is a wager for Wanderlust, which is let's see, what are the right words to describe this one? Romantasy, travelogue, mid-fantasy, a reimagining of Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days with a pansexual libertine protagonist who's ready and willing and able to sleep his way across several continents if he has to. I honestly never expect this one to sell. This one I just did basically on a personal bet. I really needed to practice certain types of scenes and thought, you know what, let's just do this. It's also the primary reason why I have a second pen name, because I do not wish to accidentally have overlap between my middle school fantasy audience and this thing. it also includes unspeakable crimes against the English language, just because I really like variant grammar and vocabulary. And you would not believe how many variant past participles there are for verbs in English. Suffice to say, there is no way in hell an algorithm is ever going to make this book. Which is all for the better, to be honest. It's fun. Just content warnings. That's part of what I needed to practice. Anyway, so yeah, so lots and lots and lots of stuff to read. I also have something on Royal Road. If you look under Michael Yatomizu, I'm slowly finishing up the typing on that, and hey, may have another series out next year for publishing. Anyway, okay, that is the full report for the first time in probably a couple months. Go read stuff, please. It is too hot this summer. Stay inside. Read books. Go, go. Okay.
Good idea. You can also read books on the beach.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean.
Joe, where can we find you?
Okay. You can still find me on twitch.tv/rpgamer every Tuesday and Thursday night, starting around 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I've got two more JRPG July streams for RPGamer this week. So hoping to finish Kingdom Hearts 1. I really hope this final dungeon doesn't take more than 4 or 5 hours to beat.
It doesn't.
Okay, good. And I've also got the rest of the Kingdom Hearts collection to play. So I don't know what my next game is going to be. I might just skip right up to Kingdom Hearts 2. I'm not sure.
That's fine.
That's what you should do.
That's what I should do. Okay.
People will say, like, oh, important things happen in Chain of Memories. And the answer is Kingdom Hearts 2 was made for people who didn't play Chain of Memories.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good to know. So, yeah. We still got more JRPG July content for the next few days, because it is, as of right now, it's July 28th where I am. But yeah, and then there's other streamers you can catch. You know, you can watch Scar, you can watch Hero Harmony. You know, just plenty of fun streams to watch this month. So I'm going to be doing that. And so last week I may have mentioned wanting to get a new headset, which I'm actually using right now. That's why maybe my voice sounds a little different or a little quieter, but I did get a new headset that I really like because my old one was falling apart. And also I did get a new capture card this week, because on my last Kingdom Hearts stream, I was getting some audio delay and stuttering, and it made me very upset. And so I was wrestling with that stupid capture card for years with different technical problems and it just not doing what was advertised. So I finally just bit the bullet, got an expensive Elgato 4KX capture card. So I'm hoping to not only use that on my RP Gamer streams, but also to make some better YouTube content for you guys to watch. So if you go to YouTube, look up Smokin' Joe Gamer. I think I'm currently up to 85 subscribers now. I think Scar just followed, so thanks for that. And haven't done a lot of content recently, but I'm hoping that this will really encourage me to put something out there. So just still ironing out a few minor technical details and finding out that there might be something wrong with the USB-C port on the motherboard. But I was just recording some gameplay of Splatoon Raiders while we were talking, and I'm just really impressed with how good it looked, and actually the sound quality was good too. So everything seems to be good there. So yeah, so check out that. And I've also been working on some music. So I've been practicing my guitar more. I've been playing my synthesizer, and I have a MIDI controller that I can use with GarageBand and other programs. So yeah, I'm looking to maybe create some more music, and that would probably end up either on my Blue Sky page or YouTube or both. So you can follow me on Blue Sky if you look up Joey at smokinjoegamer.bsky.social, I think it is. And you can also chat with me on the RP Gamer Discord server. I do spend some time in the general tab just talking about stuff. And there's also a music tab where I post songs that I like, and as do others. And so, no, there's some interesting discussions on there if you wanted to join the RP Gamer Discord channel. And we all have Blue Sky accounts as well. We don't really promote it, I guess, but all of us are on Blue Sky if you want to follow any of us. And I think that's all I got.
And I suppose that leaves us. I'm having trouble even remembering my spiel today. You can ask us questions. You can ask us questions via the chat, like dear friend Fireminer and Hero Harmony did. You can ask us questions in the Discord. The RP Gamer Discord can be joined by going to rpgamer.com, clicking the community tab. You'll find an invite there. Don't be a weirdo, and you'll find plenty of nice people to talk to. Well, be a weirdo, but don't be the bad kind of weirdo. Got it. But yeah, you can also ask us questions in the comment section under this very episode. It doesn't happen that often, but we try to keep an eye out. Otherwise, you can... if you want to catch us when we're streaming, that's usually somewhere in the range of between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific to start with on Mondays. That is 11 p.m. / midnight Eastern, again on Mondays. You can also catch our sister show, Shenanigans, where some combination of Wheels and Joe... and I and whoever happens to be there, if they're playing Overwatch, plays whatever multiplayer games pop into enough of us are active to experience. That's 9 p.m. Eastern on Sunday nights. Otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See ya.
See ya.
Okay. This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.